Electoral College?
My sense is that the lawsuits are trivial and ridiculous. There is, I think, no vehicle that would get to the Supreme Court that would overturn tens and thousands of votes in multiple states. This is not a few hundred votes from Bush v. Gore. I do think the effort to poison the waters, to muddy the question, to maybe signal to states, hey, maybe your legislature could just send some electors that are not won in the popular election, that is still in question. I think that's the thing to look at. The lawsuits are a joke, but I think the real question is, does this turn into something that is hardened into an attempt to end this?
We have to leave it there, Dahlia Lithwick. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio.
Carry it on. That's what we're still doing here at KBOO Community Radio. And that's what Buffy St. Marie has been doing for so many decades. Can't wait to see something new come out from Buffy. That would be really cool. Anyway, I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. And yes, this is the second Wednesday of the month. So we've got my second Wednesday co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, here in the KBOO studios, although we're in separate studios, separated by glass, social distancing. Anyway, hi, Jackie. Up, your microphone isn't up. Do we have her mic?
Okay, hi, can you hear me now?
Yep, hiya.
Hey, good.
So, in the midst of continued total insanity, the sad and dangerous spectacle of Trump's presidency in its seeming last days, but as they asked on Democracy Now!, is it a coup attempt or are they just pandering to Trump? But regardless, it is a lot of chaos, and there's a lot of people who are asking really questions about whether he is actively trying to steal the election. And not really trying to answer that question, I refer to a Common Dreams article. Media still refuse to report the real news. Trump is actively trying to steal the election, and Trump is staging a coup. Why are Dems not sounding the alarm? Republicans are following a clear plan to try to overturn the election results, just like they did in 2000. And once again, Democrats are not sounding a loud enough alarm. That comes from the Daily Poster by David Sirota of just yesterday. Important questions, and we're not going to talk so much about that, although if you want to chime in, please do, but I want to just introduce the topic that we're going to talk about. which you talked about quite a bit over the time that we've spent here together, the role of Indigenous Native Americans in the increasing role in the electoral process, and especially how the Navajos have definitely helped tip the Arizona blue. Of course, the margin is still narrowing, but it does seem like it is going to go to Arizona. Anyway, Arizona has voted Republican for president in every election going back to Harry Truman in 1948, with the exception of Bill Clinton in 1996. And I don't know what numbers you have, but I have a huge 86% turnout for the Navajo Nation, which is heavily for Biden and definitely had a role, along with the huge, as Juan Gonzalez was talking about on Democracy Now!, the huge increase in the Latinx vote this time around across the nation. And of course, that's in the context of a huge uptick in the vote from people of color, led by efforts like Stacey Abrams' Fair Fight, combating voter suppression, the major role of African-American women in organizing for the vote this time around. But as I said, we're going to be focusing on the role of the Indigenous vote. So with that, do you have any comments about what's going on more broadly?
Yeah, I think I brought a clip to play later on, but I did. I've done a lot of interviewing on this issue, this particular issue, particularly voting in Arizona and on the Navajo Nation in particular. I had an article come out in May, June in Sierra Magazine, and they had sent me on assignment in January of this year, right before the lockdown, and I went all over the Navajo Nation, which I should note is about the size of Ireland, and interviewed all sorts of people, from the president, President Nez, and Tara Benally, who you will be hearing from later, who is with the Rural Utah Project, also now called the Rural Arizona Project, which sought to turn out the vote on the Navajo Nation, register folks. And that was, she had really big plans to register 500 people per week, and that was definitely stymied by the COVID and the lockdowns. The Navajo Nation had some of the strictest lockdowns because they had early on an outbreak from a church rally that happened on the Navajo Nation at Chilton Veto, I think, which we discussed before, near Kayenta, and which became a vector to spreading it all over the reservation, very similar to what happened in South Korea, where a Christian meeting did a similar thing, a church rally. So she talked to me about different challenges that she was facing right before the election, how they did end up getting almost 5,000 people registered to vote with all of these challenges. Literally right now, I think he's leading just by a couple thousand, isn't he, in Arizona, Biden?
Last I heard, it was more on the lines of 8,000 to 10,000, but I could check that as we're talking.
Yeah, actually, okay. So I have here 51.655 to 1.642. So yeah, that is closer to, that's over 10,000. But that is when you realize that they were having difficulties getting, I'll get into the issues they were facing on the ground with getting registration in and getting it approved, and just how hard it is to register to vote on the Navajo Nation, which is something that we take for granted here in Oregon, because it's, when you get your driver's license, you're automatically registered to vote. But there, it's far more challenging and takes a lot more babysitting to get make sure that you are actually registered to vote.
And there's this wonderful photograph, which has made the rounds nationally, probably internationally as well, which we feature, which I picked off of Allie Young's Facebook page, of these Navajos on horseback going to vote, which is just a wonderful image and encapsulates some of the difficulties. Heck, if you get there by horseback, why not? What a great way to get to the voting place. But Allie Young's Navajo Strong group, very important. But
I definitely recommend checking that out. Her group is called Protect the Sacred, and she's Dene, and I can't remember what part of the Navajo Nation she is from, But I think I interviewed her years ago. I think that she's the same one that was an actress on that that one horrible, Ridiculous Six.
Oh, really?
I think. Let me sure. Yeah, I think so. Because yes, she was. She was the one who protested Adam Sandler's portrayal of Native women in the movie that she was cast in as an extra. And I did speak to her back then about that. She is I'm pretty sure she's a graduate of Dartmouth as well. And so, yeah, she was pretty, that was pretty horrible what happened there. I don't know if you guys remember that, but.
Yeah. Well, at least she stood up. Mm-hmm. But so, yeah, it seems like women of color are sort of the backbone of a lot of these efforts across the country.
Well, unfortunately, they have to be. I feel that, you look at the work of Stacey Abrams, where not only is her work, I mean, she, of course, famously lost the governorship because of voter suppression, the present governor of Georgia was at the time the Secretary of State, and was actually overseeing the election of which he was a candidate, which I don't think there's another democracy in the world where that is possible. And she, instead of running for president or Senate, she decided to devote her time to protecting the vote, and particularly of Black Americans in Georgia. And so she did it. She turned it out. She worked really hard. And right now they could be winning Georgia, flipping Georgia blue, and which Georgia should have been blue, I have to say, a long time ago. It's only through voter suppression that it's been a red state. And that's the case in many of these states, I suspect. We're talking old-fashioned Jim Crow style.
Of course is the real background with these really disgusting allegations of voter fraud, et cetera, that the Republicans are throwing out, and obviously in the face of the reality, which is massive voter suppression, going back to African descended people not even having the ability to vote until very, very late, including Indigenous Americans not having the right to vote. So voter suppression is an old thing, and carried on under different means up until the present.
Well, I would say that reading some of the stuff that that she had written, Stacey Abrams had written about her grandparents and how fearful her grandmother was to vote for this first time, and that was, I think, in the late 60s, which is around the same time a lot of Navajos, like my grandparents, started voting on the Navajo Nation. So it's quite there's the fear. There's the fear of terror, actually being physically assaulted, and the terrorism that goes along with it that was present in the South. I would say not so much the case on the Navajo Nation at the time, but it was more just that there was, even as you can see today, very hard to register to vote and to get your vote counted. And it's the work of women like her, of women of color. And I feel like the Democratic Party have really let us down on this matter. They have not protected our vote enough, sufficiently. They have not focused on, their focus instead is on this swing, white swing vote, right? Colloquially called, or euphemistically called, the working class vote. And never mind the fact that many Black people and brown people are working class people, right? And vote overwhelmingly for the Democratic Party. When they say winning the working class vote, they're talking about the white vote. And so it does seem like their focus has, they've allowed our rights to vote to be eroded, and they haven't been watching the shop. And really, they need to just accept the fact that their power base is going to be with people of color. And I feel like they are resisting that. The Democratic Party leadership is resisting that. They want to be a white party. They want to just appeal to white voters. They don't want to take time to protect our votes and make sure that we can turn out and address these very fundamental issues, but if they win, with Biden's win, is directly due to the work of women like Tara Benally on the Navajo Nation, and Ali Young, and Stacey Abrams in Georgia, and also, if Stacey Abrams, with the runoff in the Senate there, with the two Senate seats in Georgia coming up in January, she could actually also win them the Senate. So her work is crucial to the Democratic Party being a functioning party, and really it shows where their focus really should be.
That's going to be a knockdown, drag-out fight there in Georgia. Boy, all the eyes of the world are certainly going to be on that, and the amount of money that's going to be spent, and whether they're going to be able to continue the trend of fighting voter suppression and increasing African-American turnout and Hispanic turnout, of course.
Oh, yes. I mean, I don't mean to ignore that, but I mean, looking at how close it is and with the increased Hispanic Latinx vote in places like Arizona, that definitely has a huge part of it as well. And the youth vote as well. But you know, when you're looking at such close margins, like, you know, 10,000 votes or less in some cases, you are talking about margins that, without actually making sure that Native people are able to vote in these, like when you look at states that are completely, you know, red, you're looking at states often that don't have large Native populations. And I tweeted out that, you know, people often forget we exist. Do you know what I mean? And they forget, like, I meet people all the time who say, oh, I didn't know Native people were still around. You're the first Native person I've ever met, right? Which is shocking, I know. And, but they often don't think of us in the political equation either. But when you're looking at states, I think the National Congress of American Indians put out a great pictogram years ago that showed, like, 4 or 5 of the seats in the Senate, the U.S. Senate, are due to the Native vote. Without the Native vote there to put the thumb on the scale, you know, these Senate seats would have gone to the other party, you know, mostly the Republican Party. In one case with Senator Murkowski, she was a write-in candidate, and second write-in candidate who ever got elected to the Senate, and that was because of the Alaskan Native vote. And you see her support with things like the Savannah's Act, laws that really are of special interest to Native communities. She is very attentive to those. Even though she is a Republican, she stands with Democratic senators in support of these bills. And so definitely the Native vote, I mean, you know, if we can, you know, choose 5 or 6 senators of the 100 sitting senators in the most powerful legislative body in the world, that is a certain amount of power for the Native population.
Indeed. So I don't know if we have that sound you wanted to play. You want to go straight to that sound?
Yeah, let me just explain it really fast. So I was interviewing, I do a podcast called Pollination, for Pollination Magazine, which is a magazine I edit. And we did a series on the election, and we did three podcasts. The first one was for North Dakota, where I interviewed North Dakota State Representative Ruth Anna Buffalo, who is from Fort Berthold Reservation. And then the second one was here for Washington State, where I interviewed a Yakima leadership. And then for the third one, I interviewed Tara Benally of the Rural Utah-Arizona Project. And the Rural Utah Project got started in the 2018 election and basically organized the vote in San Juan County, which is where Bears Ears National Monument is, where the Navajo population there has been the majority but has not had the vote because of voter suppression. In fact, they were gerrymandered into one single district, so were unable to actually have any power. And they actually had to take that to court, and they won under the Voting Rights Act. And so they decided to extend their work to Arizona in order to register more Navajos in Arizona for the 2020 election. And so when I spoke to her in January, like I said, she had really ambitious goals. And then the pandemic hit, and she basically, they couldn't do anything until, they basically had to stop until almost July. They lost the entire spring. And then they started going to those different, they were doing before that drop-offs of ballots and stuff in plastic bags and stuff, and then registration forms. And then they ended up doing, actually going to where people were giving out COVID supplies, you know, and then registering Navajo voters there. But the big problem they came up against was the issue that many Navajo voters don't have physical addresses, as we had discussed in North Dakota. But they also, unlike North Dakota, do not even have emergency addresses for 911, which is what they were using in North Dakota to give people addresses. And so so basically they came with a system with Google, this plus addressing system, where based on the Google, where their Google map, where they are, and they would give them that as their address. And so they had a hard time with that because they relied on people to sort of identify themselves where they are in Google, Many of them do not have access to Wi-Fi on the reservation, and it made it really difficult to do that. And so many of the ballots got, they were basically held, and then so people would have to call and check up on their ballots regularly to find. And these are folks who do not have sometimes really access. Even cell phone service is sporadic on the reservation. There are many areas where you can't even get cell phone service, so it's quite difficult to do. So she's talking about that here. Okay, I think this is the music.
Is this a lead-in?
No, I don't think it's just an interview. So,
have you had to get plus codes for?
I know there was over, I believe, 1,000, 1,500 of forms that we still need to go back out, but I think there was more than that. That might be just half of the numbers that we were able to go back and have some people sign. But a lot of them, we weren't able to get people to sign those affidavits. And so I don't know what Apache County is deciding to do. You know, all the effort that we put into doing the voter registration drives and going out there, even with COVID happening, people really just hesitant about coming out and getting registered, but they saw the importance of the election that was coming up this year. And so people made every effort to come out and register to vote. But now we have this setback with the plus codes. And so it's really a situation, for me personally, I feel like it's another form of voter suppression. And that gets very discouraging, especially when you put hours upon hours and hours with not just myself, but with my field organizers and the community members coming out to make an effort to register to vote so they could cast their ballot, only to find out that they're not able to cast their ballot because they didn't have a plus code on their form. Apache County is trying to remedy that as well, but a lot of people don't realize until the last minute that they're on the suspension list because of just that simple thing that's missing on their form, the plus code.
Wow. And if they don't send it to you and they don't have Wi-Fi, then they have no way of really checking, right?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, to see if they're on that list.
Yeah. So there she's explaining, this is Jackie again. She's explaining how, you know, they can get on a suspension list and they won't even know that they are not registered to vote. And it's very hard for them to follow the process. Imagine having to constantly babysit your registration to vote over a period of weeks. Do you know what I mean? And that's sort of what they're up against. And not having, street addresses means that without them able to go house to house and help people identify their plus code and fill it out, it was very difficult. And so she said between 1,500 and 3,000 ballots were being held just in Apache County. And there are three counties where Coconino, Navajo, and Apache, where the Navajo Nation is predominant. And so you can see how that could be several thousand ballots that could be held in suspension. And so and that right now the election is, the lead is just by, you know, about 10,000 votes. So it's, these votes do matter, and especially in a national election like this.
You know, I heard this, what comes to mind is this, I think it was a BBC story that aired a week ago or so, that talked about in India how serious they take the ability to vote, and they talked about some priest deep in some jungle who lived all by himself, totally isolated, and they had these people who walked like 12 miles to bring this little voting machine into him, like every time they vote, which you know, I don't want to set up India as like the paragon of democratic process, but I mean, just the how absurd it is that, you know, that the amount of attention focus on so many other things, that if you just took a little bit and focused on what the real needs are of people, some system surely could be developed to address those geographical issues. I mean, it's not like, it's not rocket science.
No, yeah, I think that so in addition to registration, the other issue is, of course, the mail system. You know, I
when I was there in January, I interviewed Leonard Gorman, who was head of the Navajo Human Rights Commission, which is the office that actually pursued the lawsuit for San Juan County in Utah under the Voting Rights Act and won. And I talked to his staff. They talked to us for 2 hours. And I was going to pull a quote from there, but I didn't have a chance this morning. But one of his staffers went into great detail how she traced the mail system and how it doesn't work on the Navajo Nation for voting. Basically, the Navajo Nation doesn't have a mail system of its own. So it relies on, so all the mail, so if a ballot is sent out from San Juan County, say from Bluff, Utah, or what, I can't, like, Blanding, Utah, Monticello, Utah, that's where the county seat is in that county. It actually goes up to Salt Lake, and then it goes down to Phoenix or Flagstaff, and then it is taken up to one distribution center on the Navajo Nation, I think Loop, and then goes back up to Utah, Jimmy. And so it could take weeks to get to the person. And then on top of that, the mails, people check their mail very infrequently. Many people have to pay for PO boxes, you know, because they don't have delivery, rural delivery. So they and there are very few PO boxes, so people have to share them, and often they have to get them in a totally different precinct. Like they have to go to find a free an available PO box to purchase. They have to go to a completely different city or town on the reservation, which may not be in their voting precinct, and so. It's quite, there's a really great website. You can kind of look at that called Rigged, and it's looking at how Native Americans are denied their vote via, it's a great graphic. So it's storymaps.arcgis.com. We can put a link in the page, but it goes through a lot of what they go through. It's really, really hard to vote on the reservation, basically. And of course, voting in person is even without the pandemic is difficult because people have to drive such distances. People sometimes on average drive about 100 miles a day to go to work, right? 50 miles each way. And so, but they will have to drive home in the middle of the day on a work day to be able to vote. And over 85% of the roads in the Navajo Nation are not paved either. So it's travel is. Basically having a four-wheel drive pickup truck is required, and so it's the challenges to voting are quite extensive. And I mean, when I was talking to Tara Benali, I was thinking how easy it was for me to vote here in Oregon. You know, I got my driver's license, I was automatically registered to vote, and they send me a ballot and I go drop it off at a really, you know, just the very nearby in walking distance drop box. You know, it's really simple for me to vote, but if I was on the reservation, it would be a complete affair. I mean, it would be just quite intensive to make sure I was registered, to constantly check that, and then to finally get a ballot, and then to, you know, drive 100 miles to deliver it.
And I'm sure these problems you're talking about are greater on such a large, extremely spread out reservation like the Navajo. And I'm sure also some of the reservations in South and North Dakota. And I'm sure as well, there may be somewhat less. I haven't heard anything specifically, but, you know, there's probably similar issues on the Yakima, Warm Springs, Colville, Umatilla, some of the larger areas in the eastern parts of the states here in the Northwest, I imagine.
Yeah, we did one podcast where I have a regular co-host on my podcast, Emily Washines, who is a Yakima Nation historian and activist. And we had Patricia Whitefoot, who was an elder and a tribal leader, and they actually have more drop boxes there now than they normally do, and they seem pretty satisfied with how it was going there, but yeah, there's a lot of challenges still. I mean, I think you know, it's and then touching bases again with Ruth Anna Buffalo, who was of course elected in North Dakota in 2018 and was reelected again. But she actually replaced the state legislator who actually wrote the address law to try to suppress Native votes, and so she defeated him, but she had a lot to say regarding, you know, she's very excited that they're making progress and that there'll be, there were several more Native women and men running for the state legislature, so she won't be alone anymore in the House there.
That's what I was going to ask you. With the increase in Native participation in the vote, but also in running for office and being elected to statewide and national offices, perhaps they'll finally be able to leverage some of that political clout that Indigenous people should have based upon their their ability to tip some elections. Maybe they'll actually be able to change some of these archaic systems and impediments to the Native vote.
Yeah, I think the real attention to it and the work being done on the ground by so many folks is really helping to change that, and it will not. Having interviewed so many of them, I feel like it's going to continue. I should reiterate what you had said earlier at the top of the show, that the Navajo Times reported that this was on November 5th, that 73,954 votes went to Joe Biden from the Navajo Nation from the three counties, their Apache, Navajo, and Coconino counties, and in Arizona, and that just 2,010 went to incumbent Donald Trump. And so that is, and that's a 97% turnout for Biden, and compared to 51% statewide in Arizona. And I would say that's actually a much higher percentage than what I had done in 2018. I had done a breakdown of really looking at how the vote could impact different races, that was in Truth Out. And you can check that out. I compare Montana, North Dakota, and Arizona. And at the time, I had estimated 80% of the Navajo Nation would vote Democratic. And as you can see, it's much higher than that. I mean, everyone knows someone who is a Republican on the Navajo Nation, or a Trump supporter, but that is still 1 in 10, I guess. No, actually, that's much less. It does seem like there's more of them because you meet them, but maybe they weren't voting. I don't know, but the numbers are still coming in. So, with the one county, Navajo County, came out, had more votes for Trump. That is a county that is has a lot of large white Mormon towns in it as well, and including Snowflake, which is where the former Senator Jeff Flake comes from. And in fact, he actually supported Biden. And it's interesting to see that both of the
Cindy McCain
also supported Biden. So both of the former senators, Republican senators of Arizona, their families or themselves supported Biden. And so this flip to, now both of the senators from Arizona are going to be are Democrats. Senator Mark, recently elected Senator Mark Kelly, and then Senator Sinema, who was elected in 2018.
Well, let me just reintroduce ourselves. I'm Paul Rowland, the regular host of Wednesday Talk Radio, which is this program. And my second Wednesday co-host is Jacqueline Keeler, who herself is Navajo or Diné and Dakota. And she is a local writer and activist and my once a month co-host here on this Wednesday Talk Radio program. And I don't know if you're going to want to talk about it. I know you got your book coming out, and we're going to continue to talk about the Indigenous vote and how, among other things, Navajos helped tip Arizona blue. This is a call-in show, and this is your chance to call in. We got a half hour left. It's about 8:30. 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. Our board operator, Ty, is standing by to take your calls. So one thing I wanted to mention is speaking of Republican Native votes, the Lumbees in North Carolina became a bit of a cause célèbre because Trump made I think two trips down there and pledged to finally grant the Lumbees federal recognition, and I think I read at least one Native writer castigating Biden for not taking the Lumbees seriously. And of course, North Carolina, I think the Trump is still up 70,000 some There's still over 100,000 votes to be counted, and the Lumbees are a significant presence. You have anything to say about the Lumbee vote?
Yeah, I think that a lot of these southern tribes, you know, they're very similar to their neighbors in a lot of ways. And you notice that we also have the largest congressional delegation of Native people going to Congress this year, in addition to the first two women, Native women in Congress, Cherise Davids from a representative from Kansas, and Deb Holland from New Mexico, but we also have the Republican guys from Oklahoma who are from Oklahoma tribes. So there is a, you know, although I think that Oklahoma, I know the Cherokee Nation votes predominantly Democratic. You know, they're kind of, you'll notice that in most states, the blue counties and red states are Native reservations. There's a direct correlation there. But yeah, I think for the Lumbees, you know, they have a particular history. They are not federally recognized. They have, they're still have to answer issues regarding, you know, their history. You know, I think that's part of the federal recognition process. I can't comment on that in detail, obviously. But they have a particular history for their community, and they've been fierce fighters against the Ku Klux Klan. They're famous for having taken on the Ku Klux Klan in the 50s and beaten them in a physical fight and stuff. But they are also of their area and community, and that reflects. And also Trump had promised to make sure that they are federally recognized as well.
Yeah. So again, it looks like we have a caller. So go ahead with our first caller. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. Yourself?
I was wondering if your guest is from the Standing Rock Reservation at all.
No. My father is Yankton Sioux from the Yankton Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. Although my great grandmother was raised on the Standing Rock Reservation because her.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So.
When I was young, I worked on a mission out there, changed my entire life. I was just wondering if maybe you knew any of the people that I had met out there.
Oh well, I don't know. I mean, I did cover the Dakota Access Pipeline protest there, I know some folks there, but I don't know if I know the folks you.
I was there when AIM was just starting, and before they had gone into the Black Hills, and before the second Wounded Knee. But anyways, I have an unrelated question for KBOO. I was listening to Pastures of Plenty this morning, and they were celebrating Veterans Day, but the songs they were playing were kind of glorifying soldiers in wars, and I thought KBOO was progressive. Every war we've had since, well, even Vietnam, has been illegal or immoral, and we haven't given anyone freedom. We've usually crushed their hopes and murdered millions, if not hundreds of thousands, of their people.
Okay.
And so why are we celebrating veterans?
Well, obviously, we can't, since we had nothing to do with...
They're mercenaries.
Okay, since we had nothing to do with that show, obviously, we can't answer that.
But you're KBOO.
Okay,
KBOO should have more of a...
Okay, well, you can take that up. I think that program, you can respond directly to that program if you go to kbo.fm.
I can respond to it.
Okay.
But I want other listeners to hear this.
Okay.
And I want them to call in KBOO.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Who's losing their progressive edge?
Okay. Thank you. That's your point is made. Your point is well
yeah,
taken. Thank
well
you.
Made.
Thank you very much. All right. And I listened to a little bit about that. I think I know maybe what he's talking about. But anyway, 503-231-8187. If you want to talk about what we're talking about here today, which is the indigenous vote, indigenous participation, feel free. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Any other important areas, tribal nations votes that made a difference that you flagged that you want to talk about today?
I think that it's really, I think, important to consider how different this country would actually be without the Native vote. I mean, basically, the Native vote has maintained
quite a bit over the years a balance of power in the Senate, particularly. And in this case, may actually be delivering the presidency to the Democratic Party, which was a very close vote. And particularly Native votes in Nevada as well should be considered, because they are quite, crucial to those votes as well, those electoral college votes. And I think that looking forward, I've been talking to Native leaders about, what they are expecting from the Biden administration. And certainly there's a lot of hope there that he did announce that he is going to reinstitute the White House tribal where the tribal nations annual meeting, and so that tribal leaders can come and have access to the president directly like they did under Obama, and so a lot of people are very excited about that as well. And although a lot of I also have to say that. And I didn't. This didn't make it into my Sierra Magazine article, but I interviewed Navajos and others who over the years who have questioned Native people voting in U.S. elections, and that is based on the idea that we are sovereign nations, and that we that these are actually foreign affairs. There was actually a tribe that was citing that recently, I think I interviewed. We've had Klee Benali on the show a number of times, and he is a Navajo anarchist from lives in Flagstaff, Arizona, and he's been very active in providing COVID relief to the reservation and working with unsheltered relatives, I interviewed him when I was down there on the Navajo Nation, and he told me that. Our traditions, he was explaining to me why he's an anarchist, right? And he said he wasn't really excited about European anarchism, but what he chose to use the word for was describe actual Navajo governing structures that existed until fairly recently, which was a form of anarchy, as he judges it. And I have to say that I found his arguments very persuasive, and because we didn't have chiefs or anything like that. We were largely family groups organized by clan structures. My clan is Kinyaani, he was talking a lot about mutual aid. And the interesting thing is that it's mutual aid that really pulled the Navajo Nation and many Native communities through the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, because they were really, COVID relief was very late to come to the reservations. They received it months after the states and counties and city governments did, and it's just really what sustained the people at the time was helping each other and this traditional sort of. I mean, I don't know if you follow, but a lot of Navajos were raising money. I interviewed former Attorney General of the Navajo Nation on my podcast, and she was running a COVID relief project for the Navajo and Hopi elders, and raised millions of dollars to do that, and has just done amazing work bringing in supplies.
Do we have any callers? Looks like we have a caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello, good morning, everyone. I wanted to respond to the last caller who was quite harsh to K-Boo on the about the Pastures of Plenty music show this morning. He basically wondered why K-Boo, our progressive message community, why eulogize wars on Veterans Day. And my perception was quite the opposite. I thought K-Boo was presenting the ugliness of war and the tongue-in-cheek and this crazy music that was saying, wonderful things about going to war. And I think that's why we are progressive, is because that's not really what war is about. War kills people, hurts people, and breaks down countries, as well as the United States. So that was my take, and I thank you for a great show, this one that is currently on, and Pastures of Plenty this morning. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we've got two sides on that one. Again, I didn't listen to the whole show, and we're doing a completely different show. But and we've only got about 15 minutes left. So if you want to get your call in and talk to Jacqueline Keeler about the Native American vote and issues coming up. I mean, if you yourself are Native American, would love to hear your perspective. You can talk about how you voted, what the election meant to you, anything about your own tribe or nation that you want to talk about, or anybody else who wants to call in, 503-231-8187. So, you're starting to get into the transition to the Biden administration, which is still somewhat of a rough one, as the Trump seems to be digging his heels, as he had advertised to the world that he would do, and he's still got his minions and lackeys enabling him. But hopefully that will all resolve itself, and we can see what a Biden administration, which I myself am a little leery of, given his neoliberal leanings and his somewhat hawkish leanings. He's certainly himself not an anti-imperialist, but we're hoping that the weight of all the different forces, the youth, the people of color that have been gaining in strength, are going to have an influence on the way this administration shapes up. I don't hold out any great hopes, but yeah, you said that meeting that talk about Obama and his relationship with Native people. Do you feel that any major gains were to be made? Because obviously Biden was his vice president, so presumably there'll be some continuity there.
Well, there are. You know, I mentioned that they it's, you know, if you go to the joebiden.com, they have a Biden-Harris plan for tribal nations. And their first thing is to strengthen the nation-to-nation relationship, provide reliable, quality health care, and address health disparities, restore tribal lands, address climate change, and safeguard natural and cultural resources, ensure Native communities are safer, and tackle the crisis of violence against Native women, children, and the elderly, expand economic opportunity and community development, invest in education and youth engagement, meet obligations to and commemorate Native veterans. I should note that Native people serve in the military at very high rates, some of the highest rates in the country.
Speaking of Veterans Day.
Yes, yeah, my father is a veteran, and my grandfather and my great-grandfather on the Keeler side of my family. So, I think... It's definitely reinstating the annual White House Tribal Nations Conference, and they also have made they're going to appoint Native Americans to high level government positions. So not only to these traditionally held positions like Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs and Director of Indian Health Services, but also other governmental positions like Deputy Secretary of the Interior, White House Domestic Policy Council, White House Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, and even U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations for Human Rights. So they're offering, a little more, I think. There, of course, people, what happened at Standing Rock, many Native people feel that Obama really didn't do enough. That he seemed completely unaware of what was going on for far too long. And in my book, Standoff, that's coming out in March, I go into that in some detail. And just the way in which, he didn't fulfill the promises he had made. He had actually gone to Standing Rock, to Cannonball, which is the community that was adjacent to the encampment, and had promised them in 2014 that he would treat their children as his own. And so when they were facing this issue of their water being, endangered by this pipeline, he was nowhere to be found, basically, until really things had gotten to a really, Native people were bitten by dogs, had water cannons, on them for 5 hours straight during freezing temperatures in North Dakota in November, which the New York Times famously denounced, right, the next day. But all these things had to happen before we felt like we got his attention and he finally acted. And even then, indirectly through the Army Corps of Engineers, rescinding the permit. The other issue is with Kamala Harris. Of course, when she was Attorney General of California, she pursued a number of cases that challenged tribal sovereignty and also the right for tribes to put land into trust. And putting land into trust is where tribes will either regain lost land that used to be their traditional territory, and then the United States government agrees to put it into trust, which then takes it out of state under state jurisdiction and puts it into the jurisdiction of that native nation. And she fought those cases quite extensively in California and was an opponent to tribal sovereignty.
And has since seemingly taken a different position on that issue. But.
Yes. But it's something that I think that Native nations and Native leaders would be right to pay attention to and hold her to, especially as she may become president of the United States. I mean, not to say, but you know, that's a possibility, obviously.
Well, we've got another caller, and we only have about 10 minutes left, so let's hear what John has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Okay, I'm not really familiar with Arizona politics, but I did talk to somebody who lives down there, and they said that the state of Arizona is sort of controlled like the Koch brothers. A lot of outside money influence, sort of like how Wisconsin, you know, it was or is. But my whole thing is that after this election is over and how rancid it turned out, that maybe some of the Arizona politicians who are super conservative might punish, you know, the natives for going for Biden. This could be almost the same thing in Georgia or Mississippi or Louisiana, you know, kind of punishing, you know, the black population. I'm talking about locally, not nationally, but, you know, it seems like these legislatures are on these red states, they're very radical right. So I'm just talking about punishment, like, you know, like funds, gerrymandering, whatever, but anything that would be counterproductive for Native nations. That's all I'm just trying to point out there.
No, those are very good questions. I think, you know, a lot of it, you know, at the federal level, a lot of it relies on what happens in Georgia with the runoffs at the Senate for the Senate, two Senate seats, and which, of course, is in the hands of, you know, the work of Stacey Abrams will hopefully help with that. But at the local level, at the state legislative level and the county level, it's very important to keep an eye on that, too. I think there were a number of Native folks running at that level, and one of my podcasts, I showed an entire pictogram of all of them, and it was, you know, about 70, you know, and it's so there. And also, you know, what I was interviewing a lot of folks who have been working to turn out the Native vote, they said that engagement increases when they focus on local down ballot issues. And so really, like when I was talking to Representative Ruth Anna Buffalo in North Dakota, she said that, you know, the down ballot issues are what really turns out the voters as well. And so, you know, making sure that our young people are engaged, they can see immediate effects and impacts of their work. And so, yeah, that's a definite issue. I think the scary thing is what happened with the U.S. Census this year, which really will have a big impact on, you know, on, of course, voting in the future and also funding. So for the next decade, hopefully some kind of, you know, legislative fix can be done to try to maybe do a recount.
Have you heard anything about Native participation in the census?
It was quite low. Yeah. I mean, a lot of folks, when I was there in January on the Navajo Nation, they were talking about, you know, trying to get the census counts up, but I think it did not go well.
And they were probably like the last ones and to be, you know, because they're probably the most difficult.
Well, with the Navajo Nation and other tribes, they were often on complete lockdown on the weekend. Mm. Now, the Navajo Nation, since April or March, has been doing complete weekend lockdowns, 57-hour lockdowns, where you can't even leave the home. In fact, when I interviewed Tara Benally the Friday before the election, she was saying, well, this was our last chance to get everyone because we're going into lockdown over the weekend.
So I imagine this was probably repeated at rural reservations around.
Yeah, they couldn't do any sort of registration Saturday and Sunday. And then Monday, I guess, early voting was over in Arizona. It didn't, and they just had to wait until Tuesday to vote. But there was a lot of impediments, and then, which, of course, will affect Native communities' access to funding for DEC for the next decade. The other issue is of course the control of state legislatures are so important because they basically, that's where the gerrymandering occurs, and they can control and maintain power that way, and that's how the Republicans have been able to gerrymander districts so that they can retain power even after they've lost majorities.
Well, maybe with this upswing in, Latinx and Black and Indigenous participation and voting, maybe that will translate into their greater participation in the state legislatures.
It will, I think, but I really do think it does come to the Democratic Party finally just accepting the fact that they are going to be the party of minorities and not stop fighting that reality. I mean, I think that what this vote has shown, with 70 million turning out for Trump and those folks being primarily white, that ship has sailed. These are hard lines, and what they really need to be focusing on is protecting the Black and brown vote in this country and not allowing it to be eroded away. And that would be the main focus, I think they should. And if you look at the youth vote, there's a website called Circle, which is from Tufts University, where they go into looking at the breakdown of the voting for youth, and almost 50% of white youth voted for Trump. It's quite high, and they're really out of step with Black and brown youth. I think even Asian American youth voted for Trump, voted for Biden, in the vast majority, like over 80%. I think Latinx youth were 20% Trump, 80%, Biden.
As you say, the battle lines are drawn for now and the future. We got one more caller. We only have about 5 minutes left, so let's hear what Jeremy has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi. So you asked for us to speak about our tribes. I don't relate to being Jewish as part of my tribe. I suppose I felt vaguely around a tribe on Wednesday, the day after the election, when I went to the rally that you talked about last week, and I was expecting like 1,000 people. When I got there shortly after 3, there was 100, and by the time we left well after 4, there were maybe 200 or 300. However,
actually, I didn't ask about your tribe. I asked if there are any Native Americans listening.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. How obnoxious of me to mishear that.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, thank you very much. But I don't know. Whatever. So if anyone else wants to call in, 503-231-8187. I thought I was very clear. I was just asking if there happened to be any Native American people listening that they might want to talk about what they felt about the election, since that's what we're talking about with Jacqueline Keeler, my regular second Wednesday co-host. So yeah, we only have a couple minutes left. Any final thoughts about the election and where things are headed from here?
Yeah, so I think that I have to say it is, I don't know. I would like, it is a relief that, Trump is not going to have a second term, although apparently he, he's planning for a second term still. And I'm a little, I think that I'm very, my book Standoff looks at the polarization in American culture by examining two different events. Of course, Standing Rock and then the Bundy takeovers. And I am concerned. I'm watching it very carefully. I think that right now the far right, the Patriot Prayer folks and militia and Proud Boys right now, and the QAnon folks, they're watching. They think that they don't think the inauguration is going to happen. They think that it's all a fraud. And I think that I am concerned about violence after the inauguration on January 20th. And I think that's something that I'm not sure that this is all over. And it's very concerning that, so many people voted for Trump. It shows that this issue is not put to bed, although luckily we can address certain issues like COVID and other issues and get back into the, climate change
agreements and all these things right away. But it's we have learned something, those of us, just how precious all of this is, how important this is. It's made it far more clear, I think, in a way that maybe it wasn't before. And hopefully that will be enough. But I do worry.
I think you have a lot of reason to worry, not just about whether or not this is a real coup attempt, how it's going to go. Certainly the Proud Boys haven't gone away. The QAnon may even be strengthened by what's going on, since Fox News, which I've been watching more than usual, the commentators, it's an interesting kind of conflict within Fox. The Fox News seems to be, tending towards being more reality-based, and the commentators are going further off the deep end. But I guess we only have about 30 seconds left. So you see the standoff that you wrote about, your books coming out, you see that as probably continuing to repeat itself.
Yeah, in the book, I look at the origin stories of each group and of each part of society, indigenous origin stories of the Lakota and Dakota people, and how that impacts, their political reality today and how they relate to the world. And then and that of the Bundys, of the kind of origin stories that they are coming out of, both from Mormonism and also from their own, I actually trace it back to, they were originally Quakers and active in the English Civil War. So,
well, thank you very much with that. We look forward to seeing your book and talking more about that. Thank you, Jacqueline Keeler. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM and translator K282BH in